Good evening. It is Wednesday, February 26th, 2020, to 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you're tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Well, the White House hopefuls locked horns last night at the party's 10th presidential debate, with Senator Bernie Sanders coming under a fierce volley of attacks ahead of Saturday's primary in South Carolina. What are the takeaways from last night's scrum? Well, this is a crowded field. Will Super Tuesday cull the herd? For insight, we turn to my first guests. First, a man with a PhD in political economy. He teaches economics and politics at St. Mary's College in California and is the author of the new book, The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Policy from Reagan to Trump. And his latest op-ed is entitled, The Slander Sanders Shout Fest, The South Carolina Democratic Primary Debate. Dr. Jack Rasmus, as always, Jack, welcome back.
Always glad to be here.
We're also joined by an American sociologist and specialist in comparative historical sociology. He's a professor at University of Albany SUNY, Dr. Richard Lachman. Richard, welcome back.
Good to be with you.
So they came out swinging and kicking at Sanders from the starting bell. Bloomberg kicked off the attacks against Sanders last night, warning in the opening minutes of the debate that Russia wants Sanders to be the nominee because he'll lose to Trump. How long do they keep beating this dead horse, Jack Rasmus?
Well, they'll keep beating it until they drive Sanders out of the race, which isn't going to happen, or they take it from him at the convention coming up for the party in Milwaukee in June. Look, it's a really stop Sanders campaign right now. You've got the moneyed forces, the corporate wing of the Democratic Party rallying, and their centrist candidates are backing them up and carrying their water now in these debates. And you can see it very clearly. Of course, that particular charge by Bloomberg really has no basis in any kind of evidence. And even the government bureaucrats who floated that idea that Russians are supporting Trump because supporting Sanders because he's the easiest candidate for Trump to beat. Even the bureaucrats have backed off of that, but obviously Bloomberg ran with it and threw it out there at the very beginning, even though it's quite clear that 47 major polls that have been held in the last several weeks show that in all of them, Sanders is actually out-polling Trump, something like 49 to 45, whereas the other delegates are all even or losing to Trump. So the argument that they're really pushing now is sort of a corollary of that, which says that, even if Sanders wins, the down ballot results will be he'll lose the House majority and more in the Senate, which, of course, there's no evidence for that at all. As Sanders keeps arguing, if you want to beat Trump, you got to have a movement. And, of course, that movement is building behind him. But it's not a movement that the centrist and the corporate wing of the Democratic Party really want, because it's a movement that's based on let's tax the billionaires, let's kick the insurance company parasites out of the healthcare system, let's give education, free education in public colleges to kids, let's do something about their indentured trillion-plus debt, etc. Well, these are issues that they don't like. So the centrist candidates who are going to be driven out after Super Tuesday, I'm talking about Klobuchar for sure, possibly even Buttigieg, and if Biden does not win by a large margin in South Carolina, he too will be gone. Those people are carrying, along with Bloomberg, the corporate guy, carrying the water for the Democratic corporate wing.
Dr. Richard Lachman, as an American sociologist, especially one who specializes in comparative historical sociology. If you could answer that question about them continuing to kick this dead horse about Putin wanting Sanders to win in the context of Cold War, red baiting, and how this whole anti-Russian narrative is so prominent in American zeitgeist.
Yeah, I mean, it never stops. And, you know, part of it's that these candidates, except for Buttigieg, grew up in the Cold War. You know, just like the U.S. military spends most of its budget to buy weapons designed to fight a Soviet Union that hasn't existed for 30 years, these people organize their campaigns around a Cold War, you know, with all the discussion of Sanders having taken a supposed honeymoon in the Soviet Union, or, you know, that he pointed out that Cuba has had real successes in healthcare and education, that they somehow imagine that the American public sees that as a negative and a reason not to vote for him. I mean, what's interesting is they've, for the most part, given up criticizing any of the substance in Sanders' proposals. You know, they're not saying, vote for me instead of him because my health plan's better, or, you know, I have make more economic sense. Their only remaining argument is somebody like Sanders can't win. We've got to beat Trump. And, you know, it's all based on, it's certainly not based on the polls, because as we just heard, Sanders is doing better against Trump than any of the others. It's based on the idea that somehow, if Sanders gets the nomination, then there'll be a Republican propaganda machine that'll go after him in a different way from any of the other Democrats. But, you know, in fact, the Republicans are going to call all of them, even Bloomberg, a socialist.
You know, last night, Sanders said that political leaders must face up to America's long record of toppling democratically elected governments overseas, quote, excuse me, occasionally it might be a good idea to be honest about American foreign policy. That includes the fact that America has overthrown governments all over the world, in Chile, Guatemala, in Iran. Now, you put that with Bernie saying that Netanyahu is a racist. He's telling Americans, in my opinion, exactly what they need to hear. Now, the pundits aren't pleased with Sanders' remarks, But progressives have applauded him. Jack Rasmus, along with what Richard Lachman just mentioned about the Castro issue, A, I love the fact that Bernie's telling the truth, but more importantly, he's not backing down from what he's saying. He's not saying he was taken out of context. He's saying, no, folks, I'm telling you the truth. Jack Rasmus.
Well, that's one of the appeals of Bernie, particularly to the youth. You know, he's authentic. You know where he stands, and he's not budging from that stance. And those programs and those proposals, whether they're domestic programs or his views on foreign policies, people want to hear something fresh and honest. They're tired of the equivocating and all of the, you know, rigmarole that they hear from these centrist candidates, particularly young voters. And, you know, what you see is what you get. Sanders, he's not backing down from any of his domestic programs either. And in fact, he's the only one that's really proposing domestic programs, what you can tell in these debates, apart from maybe Warren talking about her plan for Medicare, which she doesn't go into much detail about. You know, these debates are really about Bernie proposing programs and policies, and the other candidates trying to take his proposals apart without saying what they're really for, except to say, oh, in the past, I did this, I did that. Well, voters want to know not what you did in the past, but what are you going to do for me now and in the future? And that's what one of his big appeals really is, and makes him out from all the other candidates up there.
Richard Lachman, same point to you. And I don't want people to think that this is a biased Bernie love fest, but I'm just trying to point out as honestly as I can the disingenuous and dishonest tactics that CBS and the other entities have been taking and how they present this information to the American people.
Oh, definitely. I mean, you know, the moderators in these debates are a disgrace. You know, they're so they manage to be both biased and stupid at the same time. It's quite an achievement.
And that's a dangerous combination.
Yeah. And, you know, I think on domestic policy, you can make an argument that Warren is fairly close to Sanders and sort of the breadth and depth of her proposals. But in foreign policy, Sanders really stands alone in his criticism of militarism and anti-democratic intervention around the world.
As we look at the upcoming primary that's taking place in South Carolina this coming Saturday, Jack Rasmus, there's been an awful lot of focus on the African-American vote. And in South Carolina, it seems as though there's going to be a generational split based upon age, in terms of the age demographic. Now, you've got Biden seeming to have 19 members of the Congressional Black Caucus endorsing him. What's your sense of what to look for on Saturday as it relates to the black vote in South Carolina?
Well, you know, 60% of the Democrat base in South Carolina are black. And Biden thought he had that as a firewall wrapped up. Well, he thought he had a firewall in Nevada, and that one imploded as well. But, you know, if you look at the latest polling, it's 27% of the black vote in South Carolina for Biden and 23% and rising for Sanders. Look, you know, if Biden does not win that segment of the vote overwhelmingly, and he's not right now, then he's toast. The money will run away from him in Super Tuesday. It's already dribbling out. And after Super Tuesday, he's just going to be hanging in there, if at all. And all Sanders has to do is come a close second, and it will be clear that black and minority youth under 35 are flocking to Sanders because those are the folks that are really, really hurting out there in the electorate. You know, it's not the 50, 60-somethings who have money in the bank and secure jobs. It's the millennials, the Gen Zers, the Gen Xers. These are folks that are working for cheap, low-paid service jobs, two and three of them with no benefits, suffering under trillions of dollars of debt, student debt, can't form families, can't live on their own. These are the people who are really hurting, and these are the people going for Bernie. This is the big demographic reality, and you see it reflected in South Carolina now as well, and you will see it in Super Tuesday. The question is, can that group and that turnout, which is a movement now, can they give him a majority of the delegate votes before the convention? We'll see. If they don't, then very clearly the Democratic Party leadership, which is the money side of the party, has over 500 special delegates in their back pocket who are mostly congresspeople and senators, and they're going to vote the way Pelosi and Schumer want, and they'll take the election, the nomination rather, from Sanders once again. And that will cause a tremendous implosion in the Democratic Party, I predict.
Richard Lachman, a number of folks have been saying that the black vote is key in South Carolina. And again, you've got 19 members of the Congressional Black Caucus on record as backing Joe Biden. If Biden, as Jack just said, either doesn't win by the overwhelming margin that he's expected to, or if he should lose to Bernie Sanders, what does this say, if anything, about the narrative of the black vote, particularly as it relates to the Congressional Black Caucus being able to deliver a constituency? Should that be a concern?
Well, I mean, it's a concern for them, but although, you know, they have state seats, they can remain in the House for the rest of their careers. Look, these are the same people who 12 years ago endorsed Clinton over Obama. They're party hacks, and, you know, we shouldn't expect any changes from that.
What about the fact now, and Jack, you mentioned that the money is moving out away from Biden. the money also seems to be moving away from the DNC. There are some reports that the DNC is damn near broke, which is one reason why Bloomberg has been looked upon so favorably, because he's able to underwrite his own campaign without requiring an infusion of cash from the DNC.
Well, I'm not so sure the DNC is broke, you know, reportedly.
Well, broke is relative.
Yeah, right. I think it's, raising campaign funds mostly. But look, Bloomberg reportedly gave the party, the DNC, $50 million. And, of course, they changed the rules and debates to let him in. As a result, he's bought his way not only with ads, of which he's probably spent $500 billion already, he's bought his way with ads. And, of course, he's bought his way into the Democratic Party. But as Warren pointed out, this is the Republican and Democrat sheep's clothing, Bloomberg, who campaigned and gave millions to Lindsey Graham in South Carolina, who gave $3 million to the Republican governor of Michigan, who is responsible for all the poisoned water there, doing nothing, and who's given all kinds of money to other candidates, the Republicans as well. This is a guy who has one foot in the Republican Party and one foot in the Democrats, and he plays both ends. And he's really a Democrat in the debate bunch, far more than even centers. So, Warren really did another trip on him, but it doesn't seem to faze him or the Democrat leadership, because he's feeding them all kinds of millions.
Richard Lachman, final question to you along the same lines.
There's a long history of the Democrats and the Republicans putting up, people with no political history or out-and-out buffoons for office because they're able to self-finance. And that's certainly the appeal of Bloomberg. And, I think they're somewhat surprised that he did so incredibly badly in these debates. But, this is nothing new.
What about the fact that, for the most part, it really looks like Bloomberg has been able, just through campaign ads and his ability to underwrite his own campaign with endless resources, that he's been able to have the effect on the process that he's had simply just upon advertising?
Oh, yeah. No, advertising can get you pretty far, but it almost never gets you all the way. And in this case, it won't either.
Dr. Richard Lachman, American sociologist and specialist in comparative historical sociology, professor at University of Albany SUNY, thank you for your time. Dr. Jack Rasmus, PhD in political economy, teaches economics and politics at St. Mary's College in California, and author of the book, The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Policy from Reagan to Trump. Gentlemen, thank you both for your time. Thank you for your contribution to the Critical Hour. And as always, look forward to having you back.
Good to talk with you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Really appreciate it. All right, folks, you're listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Well, Julian Assange appeared before a British court for a third day today to fight the extradition request from the United States, which wants to put the 48-year-old on trial for hacking government computers and violating an espionage law. Let's go to Woolwich Crown Court in Southeast London and our Loud and Clear producer, Walter Schmolerik, who's there on the ground. Walter, good evening to you and welcome back.
Glad to be here.
So give us your quick assessment of what transpired today, the third day in court. We know that the prosecution presented their opening salvo Monday. The defense came back yesterday. So where are we today?
Yeah, so today in court, the two sides argued over, a number of issues. The greatest amount of time was dedicated to the question of essentially whether or not international law applied to the UK and whether or not what Julian Assange is accused of, right, or these espionage charges, do they constitute a political charge? So just to reiterate some legal background we've been going over this week. So the United States and the United Kingdom have an extradition treaty with each other, but there's a clause in that extradition treaty saying that this doesn't apply in the event of or in instances of political charges. And this is, you know, today in court, Julian Assange's lawyers were making the point that this is a clause that's found in almost every extradition treaty, you know, going back hundreds of years. So they were making that case. It got sort of into
But hang on. Didn't they make that point saying that this is a clause that the U.S. puts in treaties going back almost 100 years because the United States does not want its citizens to be extradited to other countries?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and so the response to that by the lawyers representing the United States, so the people who want Assange to be extradited, was really shocking. So what they argued, and apparently this has some basis in the British legal system, is that international law does not apply to the UK, that none of the agreements that the UK signs are actually legally binding unless Parliament votes them into, you know, domestic law. So the argument is that, yeah, that Parliament is sovereign. The only source of, you know, legal legitimacy is a vote by the British Parliament. So believe it or not, you know, every international agreement, every treaty that the UK signs is essentially just like a good faith like agreement or, you know, like a suggestion, unless the UK Parliament subsequently votes in parallel language to, you know, the domestic legal code. And so the UK has a domestic extradition law that was passed in 2003. And in that UK extradition law, there is no clause about political cases, about political charges being, you know, exempt from extradition proceedings. So, you know, you had this very extensive presentation, I think, you know, in preparation for what will almost inevitably be an appeal by Julian Assange's lawyers that, like, look, this is like the most standard basic thing in basically all extradition treaties, like political charges are exempt. And then you have the lawyers of the United States' position saying, it doesn't matter. We don't care. International law doesn't apply to the UK. Only Parliament matters.
So, Walter, one of the interesting things to me about that point is that Britain is a signatory to the International World Court. So unlike the United States and Israel, who have not even signed on to that, the fact that Britain has signed on is still irrelevant because the British Parliament hasn't passed specific legislation?
Well, that's the astonishing argument that the prosecution is laying out here in the courtroom. And there is, you know, a history of similar defenses being accepted by the UK court system. For instance, you know, I was learning today about an attempt in 2004 to take the UK government to court, well, basically to, you know, file charges against the government of Tony Blair in UK courts over the invasion of Iraq. The argument being that the supreme international crime, you know, according to the UN Charter, according to the, you know, precedent of the Nuremberg trials, is to launch a war of aggression, right? That's the supreme international crime. And so that's what the UK government did. And so, you know, we're taking you to court. And what the UK government argued in response is, you know, exactly what I laid out, you know, that that doesn't matter. Parliament never passed a law saying a war of aggression is a crime. And so your argument is invalid. And that was actually accepted at the time in 2004.
Wow. You know, one of the other things that I found interesting today was that Assange was complaining that he can't really participate in his defense because he's not able to sit next to his defense team in court. He's in this glass dock is where he's being held. And the judge, Vanessa, is it Barrister? Is that her?
Barrister, yeah. Barrister, yeah.
Yeah, she said, well, I can't really do anything about it. That's a security. So she couldn't do anything yesterday about guards taking his court records. She can't do anything about that. And now in her courtroom, she can't do anything about how far away Julian Assange is seated from his defense team. You know, is this woman helpless? I mean, what? This just to me seems crazy.
Yeah, this was maybe the most dramatic thing to happen in court today. So at one point, Julian Assange gets up. So he's in this like box, basically, you know, covered in bulletproof glass, just to, you know, it's obviously a maneuver to portray him as this violent threat, this dangerous, you know, terrorist or whatever. Because, I mean, like, what's that for? Like, is he going to pull out a gun and start shooting people? I mean, it's completely outrageous. So he's in this box, right? He's been in this box since the beginning of the trial. In addition to being, you know, very demeaning, demonizing, dehumanizing, it also prevents him from, you know, communicating effectively with his lawyers. And so he got up, you know, midway through today's session and, you know, from behind this box said, like, can I please go sit with my lawyers? And so, you know, at first, the initial response by the judge was like, you can't be speaking right now. The only reason you'd be allowed to speak in this courtroom is if you decided to provide evidence, right? If you decided to testify and you're not, so like, shut up. And then she actually paused the proceedings for like 10 minutes so that Julian Assange could go and talk to his lawyer. Another complaint he had about being in this box is that because he's surrounded by, you know, usually two guards at all times, he also can't consult confidentially either with his lawyer, as is his right. So they come back into the courtroom after about 10 minutes and Julian Assange's lawyer makes, you know, the formal request to the judge, like, hey, can Julian Assange come sit with us? And so she says, like you said, that's a security risk. Like, I'm in no position to make a security assessment about that. You know, that has to be handled by, you know, the security professionals. And you know, she was completely hostile to the request. And they, you know, go back and forth. And then I think, you know, she was probably seeking an out from this, turn to the lawyer representing the United States side, the pro-extradition lawyer. Mm-hmm. And so he astonishingly said, yeah, that'd be fine with us if he comes and sits with you. You know, he said he was neutral, and then you know, the judge, clearly annoyed by this, starts arguing with the prosecution lawyer, and the prosecution lawyer is actually making the case for why Julian Assange should be allowed out of this, you know, bulletproof box. I mean, it was really remarkable. Like, and so this was the judge's actual argument. It's shocking. So she said that while he's in the box, he's in custody. If he was taking the stand, right, if he was testifying, that would constitute Assange being in the custody of court. But the table, this is all in the same room, but the table where his lawyers are, for him to go sit there, that would actually require him to be granted bail.
That's like him being at the airport.
That's, yeah.
That, what a lot of people don't know is, you know, when you get to an international airport, there are sections of the airport that are considered to be, what, international space, right? So,
yeah.
So yeah. They'd be like taking him to the airport. That's so stupid.
Yeah, it's totally outrageous. And she kept going, and he's like, you know, Julian Assange's lawyer would say something and she would be like, is that a request for bail? Are you requesting bail? It's like, no, I'm not requesting that. I just want him to move like a few feet in the same room up next to me.
Wow. And he even said at one point while he's in the dock, he says, I can't hear. Mm-hmm. And then he also complained, I'm as much a participant in these proceedings as I am at Wimbledon.
Yeah, I mean, it's really true. It's shamefully true. You know, he just has to, you know, the only time he actually gets addressed at all, which is very, very, very few times, is just to check in to see if he's medically capable of being conscious, basically. You know, he's on medication, you know, because he's been abused so horribly at the hands of the British prison system. And so, you know, that makes it hard for him to, you know, stay active, you know, to actually be in a mental state where he can follow what's going on. So they want him to be like awake, I guess, but that's pretty much it.
Now, she got very upset that someone took a picture in the courtroom and said that if she found anyone taking or trying to take photos, that they'll be in contempt. I want to make it absolutely clear it's a criminal offense to attempt to take a photograph in any court. So she can find the authority to deal with photographs, but she can't seem to find the authority to deal with the actual conduct of the trial.
Yeah, it's obvious that this judge is completely biased against Julian Assange. I don't think anybody observing, you know, today especially would say that, you know, Julian Assange is having a fair trial. It's clearly a kangaroo court. You know, the decision yesterday certainly was another indicator of this, right? That she wouldn't intervene in this, you know, horrific treatment of Julian Assange by the prison authorities, like as the trial is going on, confiscating his legal papers, stripping him naked, handcuffing him, shuffling between room and room and room throughout the night. You know, so that kind of set the tone. And today it was proved, you know, even further, I think, that this is a completely unfair trial.
Is this a jury trial or is this a hearing? Well, and it's not actually it's an extradition hearing. It's not a trial. So is there a jury or is this just a bench hearing?
It's just a hearing, and it's almost certain to be appealed to both to higher UK courts. And another option available to Assange's lawyers would be to appeal this case to the European Court of Human Rights as well. So there's a long legal battle to go from here.
Okay. So again, this part of the hearing lasts until Friday. Then there's a break until May, and then it picks up in May.
Yeah. So right now they're hearing arguments related to abusive process. And so then there'll be a pause, and then there'll be a second batch of hearings in May. And so, you know, I think that this is going to be something that drags on for a long, long time. But, you know, if it's in a UK court, like I mean, I'm not an expert on the UK legal system, but if this judge is any indication, and if, you know, I mean, we can just think logically about the politics surrounding this, right? I mean, the UK is, you know, perhaps the closest ally of the United States. You know, they're, and especially in the wake of Brexit, that's a very important relationship to them. You know, is the UK government, you know, any arm, any branch of the UK government really going to have the courage to defy the United States like that? You know, maybe if there's a tremendous amount of grassroots pressure on them, but their inclination, as was demonstrated very clearly in the courtroom today, was to, you know, just kowtow to the United States.
So what is supposed to happen tomorrow? Is tomorrow just a further extension of today, or is there another element to this that is to unfold or to be presented tomorrow?
Well, so one thing that's going to happen tomorrow is that this issue of where Julian Assange sits, which is very important, is going to come up again, perhaps even the first thing. So the way that back and forth between, ironically, both lawyers and the judge about, you know, Assange being able to sit with his legal team, the way that was resolved was basically, you know, after a really extensive back and forth, that, you know, like the judge was like, look, defense attorney, you should just present, like, let's talk about it in the morning, basically. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, put together your petition, put together your request, and then, you know, we'll consider it. So that'll be some, you know, that'll be an important thing that's decided tomorrow. You know, this question of, you know, these questions related to international law and its applicability inside of the UK, that's something that, you know, certainly hasn't been resolved either. You know, the whether or not what Julian Assange did was political, or whether or not, you know, the Espionage Act constitutes political charges, that may continue to be something that's debated, although it seems like that is now going to be of secondary importance, you know, at least in terms of the presentation of the, you know, pro-extradition lawyers to this, you know, very simplistic argument, basically, this doesn't matter. The 2003 UK extradition law is what matters.
Walter Schmolerick, a producer of Loud and Clear. He's joining us from Woolwich Crown Court in Southeast London, covering the Julian Assange extradition hearing. As always, Walter, thanks so much for your time. Look forward to talking to you tomorrow.
Thank you.
All right. All right, folks, you are listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. U.S. Supreme Court bars lawsuit over cross-border shooting of Mexican teen. Yesterday, the U.S. Supreme Court barred a lawsuit against a Border Patrol agent, Jesus Mesa, for fatally shooting a 15-year-old Mexican young man, Sergio Adrian Hernandez, in the face in 2010. He was on Mexican soil from across the border in Texas. This now refuses to open the door for foreign nationals to pursue civil rights cases in American courts in such incidents. The court ruled 5-4 to uphold the lower court's dismissal of the lawsuit against the agent. What does this mean for immigrants going forward? Well, for insight, we turn to my next guests. First, she is a nationally known immigrant rights activist, co-founder of the Latinx organization Mejente, and a community organizer with Northwest Detention Center Resistance, Ms. Maru Moravillapando. Welcome back.
Thank you for the invitation.
We're also joined by an attorney with Perez and Malik Attorneys at Law, Carlos Castaneda. Carlos, as always, welcome back.
Always a pleasure.
So, Ms. Moravillapando, let me start with you. Your just overall thoughts on this 5-4 ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, I guess the first impact that we see is the impact of this current fascist regime waiting for the opportunity that was built by the Republicans during the Obama administration to have judges that are political, that are leaning with the right-wing establishment, to precisely create these kind of decisions. It was obviously a party line decisions, according to what I read. But, I think the four dissident judges are not party line. They're just going with what is the common sense work that they're supposed to be doing and executing as Supreme Court judges. At the same time, it builds our case even stronger now that this administration doesn't want to be accountable, including for cases that happened such a long time ago that are not unique, continue happening, and even for those that were killed, not even on U.S. soil, not even with any kind of excuse to be killing young people across the border. I think it's appalling that this happened. And, again, it's not unique. It continues happening until today in different ways and forms. But most importantly, I think, is the fact that we have now these five judges that are leaning with the current administration, and we cannot rely now on our Supreme Court system to actually bring justice to our families and to the different levels of impunity that we have now in this country, including that of the Border Patrol and Immigration Customs Enforcement.
Carlos, the young boy's family sued in federal court seeking monetary damages, accusing the Border Patrol agent Mesa of violating the U.S. Constitution's Fourth Amendment ban on unjustified deadly force and the Fifth Amendment right to due process. The ruling, which matched the position taken by the Trump administration in the case, ended litigation also involving a similar incident in which a Border Patrol agent fatally shot a 16-year-old Mexican named Jose Antonio Elena Rodriguez from across the border in Arizona. There is some question as to actually what happened in this case where, let me see, U.S. Border Patrol said the teenager was throwing rocks at the agents. The FBI has accused him of being a migrant smuggler. And lawyers representing the family said he was simply playing a game in which a group of teenagers would run across the culvert from the Mexican side and touch the U.S. border fence and then run back to the Mexican side. Your thoughts on what I just laid out?
Indeed. And actually, I do remember that incident from when I was in El Paso in 2010 with family. That was on the news then, and it was the big issue then. And now as an attorney, it's certainly a very interesting issue now. Now, regarding this lawsuit, it's important to stress two things. One, we are talking about a violation of the Constitution in terms of this federal government officer's actions. And two, the crucial issue for the Supreme Court in this decision was whether or not it should extend constitutional remedies to acts that have occurred outside the United States. Now, while a bullet may have been fired from the U.S. side, it entered into Mexican territory and killed someone in that territory. The way the court looked at this was as followed. And I should say the way the majority of the court looked at it was as followed. And there is plenty of nuance here to have a bit of deference, if not respect, for that decision, despite its controversy. And I stress that for the following reason. The way, the only way, that the plaintiff could have had a cause of action to sue this Border Patrol official is if the federal courts would allow constitutional law to extend to a new category. We're talking about a new way of suing the federal government under an old decision that allows an extension of damages claims when no federal statute specifies it, but a violation of the Constitution has occurred. This stems from a case from the 1970s called Bivens. Now, when you look at whether or not such a Bivens claim should be extended, the court, under its own decisions, has to use a two-step process. And let me just mention very briefly what that is. First, you have to see if this claim is in a, quote, new context. And second, you see if the courts themselves should delve into that area or if they should back off. That is, this two-step process requires judges, and this is very important, it requires judges to see whether or not they, the courts, should give this kind of relief to a victimized individual. And in this case, the court said no, because even though Hernandez, the young man, and his family had met the first requirement in this two-step process, they agreed that this arose in a new context because of the reasons I mentioned before. As to the second step, they said that if courts get involved in this situation in which a person has been killed or injured in a foreign country due to actions by a U.S. government official, that could create foreign relations problems, interfere with the responsibilities of the executive branch, and also, they said, interfere with border security. Now, these arguments were criticized by the dissenting justices here.
Mm-hmm.
But the key point to take away is this. The Supreme Court said that judges, or at least the federal judiciary, should not open up this door without authorization from another statute. And I just want to give a couple of examples from other statutes that do or that are intended to protect individuals, such as the Torture Victims Protection Act, that is not used to sue a United States official, but is used to sue foreigners for acts of violence perpetrated and use U.S. courts. Another example is the Federal Tort Claims Act, in which you can sue a U.S. official for claims that occurred in the United States, but not specifically not for any claim in the foreign country. And it is worth noting that the Mexican government had requested to the Obama administration to extradite the Border Patrol official to Mexico so that he would face justice under Mexican courts, and that was denied.
Of course, they're not going to do that.
Exactly. And so for all these reasons, five out of nine justices on the Supreme Court said, you know what, even though this is a sympathetic case, we don't want to interfere too much with this. It creates too many issues. A controversial decision, but one that does have sufficient reasoning under the law.
To your point about having sufficient reasoning under the law, is this, and let me see if I can ask this succinctly, is this a matter of the justices trying to find a way not to hear it? Or I understand you're saying it's based in law, but there are a lot of things that are based in law that don't necessarily, that can go a number of different ways.
Absolutely.
Because we know that the courts can find ways to rationalize just about anything they want to rationalize. And that takes me back to, I can't remember the name of the specific case, but it was a case of Christmas decorations. And the court held, well, Christmas is a national holiday, not a religious holiday. So, I mean, they can justify anything they want to. So does my question make sense and your answer?
It absolutely does.
Okay.
It absolutely does. And there certainly is a lot to say as to that explanation. it very well could be that the majority of the justices just did not want to go into this area because of, shall we say, pressure from the presidency. Although, even at this stage, federal judges have a great level of self-respect, and they don't like other branches of government trying to tell them what to do any more than other branches of government like it when the judiciary steps in. So I don't see enough to say that they were just trying to find an excuse.
Okay.
They were trying to be, and I don't mean this in an ideological way, they're trying to be conservative when it came to the remedies available to a person.
Understood. They needed a more compelling reason to expand the perspective.
Or at least a less problematic remedy. The problematic part was one that turned them off.
Okay, because Alito says in writing for the majority, the case presented, quote, foreign relations and national security implications, end quote, and noted that Congress should decide whether such lawsuits can be permitted. Whereas Ginsburg wrote, Mesa's allegedly unwarranted deployment of deadly force occurred on United States soil. It scarcely makes sense for a remedy trained on deterring rogue officer conduct to turn upon a happenstance subsequent to the conduct, a bullet landing in one half of a culvert, not the other.
Indeed. And this basically proves my point. This is one of those Supreme Court decisions in which you could really see it going either way, regardless of the ideology of the justices, regardless of one's point of view. If you look at the law and apply it as it has been prepared, you can see both sides having rational reasons for either extending this remedy or restricting it.
Okay. Ms. Maru Mora Villapando, how is this playing out in the immigrant rights community that you represent? And what's the sense of this amongst the immigrant rights activists community?
Well, I think it was a very good explanation of, you know, rationally and legally speaking, why this decision might send sense to some. But, you know, behind this court decision, there was a lot of fight originally, right? The families tried different ways and methods to bring justice to their child. And it, like I said, it's not the only case. We know of other cases where Mexican people have been killed by Border Patrol in Mexican soil. Obviously, also people have died on their Border Patrol custody in U.S. soil. And I think what it plays to us is, again, the sense of impunity that these officers can take lives, you know, without any reason or maybe motivated by something specific that they never disclosed. And what we end up with is no justice whatsoever. We feel that we are completely at the mercy of these officers that feel that they can take away our lives, and they know there will be no accountability. So it just grows our sense of indignation and outrage. It validates the sense that we cannot rely on law to bring justice to our plight. And so we continue organizing from the most basic, you know, ways we can do, which is protecting each other. And that's why you've seen so many now groups coming together and arriving at places where they know that a Border Patrol is hunting down immigrants. Same with ICE. And, you know, there's a lot of rapid response groups around the nation nowadays. People are also taking notes by documenting, right, doing taking videos with their cell phones, et cetera, because we know we cannot rely on the law to bring justice. These officers are part of an agency that has gone rogue, not only now, but from so many years. I mean, it's an agency that goes and kills the same way they go in and rape, you know, the budget from other agencies, such as FEMA. In the midst of hurricane season, we saw ICE taking the first year $10 million and the year after over $100 million, where people was being killed, you know, literally by the abandonment of this administration, like the Hurricane Maria. And this agency is willing and able to take money from the funds that are supposed to be there for people that are suffering natural disasters. And at the same time, there are officers that, you know, they take the law in their hands and they decide their judges and executors and kill people knowing, again, there's not going to be any accountability. And so I think we will just continue seeing that our lives are at the mercy of these officers and this agency. And that's why we need to continue fighting to abolish the entire immigration enforcement agency as it is right now.
Carlos, to Maru's point, does this set a very deadly precedent for Border Patrol agents that they can, at least as far as the border is concerned, indiscriminately shoot people on the other side of the border and they don't have to worry about retribution or repercussions of their actions?
The idea of impunity was really at the heart of this case, and I have great sympathy and empathy for the family. Having said that, I don't believe this creates a precedent of impunity completely, because that Border Patrol official, Mesa, he had his life basically, in the Border Patrol at least, ended because of that, as well he should. And I do not know as to any other internal disciplinary repercussions that he faced, but this is not something that Border Patrol in general tends to do lightly, both because of their internal rules and because of PR. The Border Patrol is very sensitive to how the public, including the international public, views them. I would say the following, though. Given the controversies surrounding ICE and Border Patrol and many immigration agencies, the idea of impunity is one that I, as an immigration lawyer, don't just see in terms of potential litigation for damages such as this. I see it on a regular basis in other smaller issues. So that feeling of helplessness or powerlessness is one that I always try to overcome, but do see on a regular basis as part of my practice in the faces of my clients. So there's a lot to be said as to that.
Let me switch gears, Maru, and go to a report that's just been released. Family separations at the border constitute torture. The separation of families by U.S. immigration officials at the U.S.-Mexico border amounts to torture, according to a group of medical and human rights experts that performed psychological evaluations of asylum seekers. Their report for Physicians for Human Rights, a U.S.-based nonprofit that investigates human rights violations around the world, found that the policy of family separation, which officially ended in the summer of 2018 but continues today, quote, constitutes cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, end quote. In other words, torture. Maru, your thoughts on this report?
Well, yeah, we were aware of that report being written by Physicians for Human Rights. We actually been in touch with them. Several organizations have for the past 2 years. We have obviously seen the impacts of that inhumane policy, as many others, you know, again, they were built by, in this case, this administration and implemented by the immigration enforcement agencies. And we saw the impact here, actually, in Seattle, Washington, where 200 women were transported from the southern border all the way to the SeaTac Federal Detention Center, separated from their children. I mean, we've seen already the impact of on children where their parents are taken away. And this has been happening for, well, 30 years now. I actually met a young woman in her 30s that was put in an adoption after her father was deported, and she's now in her 30s. So this is not new. The difference, though, is that those children were not put in cages, and now they are. And obviously, if there's already impact in adults, which we already seen, you know, everybody that we talk to that are in detention centers, when they come out, they talk about having to adapt themselves to, you know, being able to sleep through the night because they sleep in big pods with hundreds of other people, and they usually have also the lights on, the fact that you're being monitored 24/7, et cetera. And if the impact for adults is long lasting, imagine what it is for children. So I think that, you know, when Carlos talked about the Border Patrol being worried about their image, I disagree with that, because we actually saw this precisely well-crafted policy to funnel immigrants to Ciudad Juarez to be waiting, right, and then be put under the bridge, literally, just surrounded by a fence. And they allow the pictures. They allow the media to come in and take pictures because they wanted to create this sense of there was no way we could actually make it through the border for those that were apprehended.
Okay.
Not the first time that that kind of policy has been implemented. Remember what happened also in Arizona when they pretty much closed the border and people had to go through the desert. So these inhumane policies are just way too much. And again, to me, it's very clear that these agencies are trying to pretty much commit genocide against our communities and run with it without accountability.
Carlos, final question to you and on the same issue. As an attorney, your thoughts on this report, and does this become another data point for you as you build cases in support of your clients?
I'm very glad you mentioned that last point, because it does serve as evidence that I use to build up when it comes to helping my clients in their cases. Though it's fairly rare for an immigration lawyer to try to win a case based on treatment of someone by Border Patrol officials, that is something that certainly is possible. And I do want to emphasize that the fact that this report is coming out basically around the same time as this Supreme Court decision is coming out, I really can't say whether or not that's completely coincidental, is, I think, overall a positive, because it shows that the Border Patrol actions are and should be placed under a strong spotlight.
Let me thank you both, Ms. Maru Mora Villapando from Northwest Detention Center Resistance, as well as Mijente. And we were also joined by Carlos Castaneda from Perez and Malik, attorneys at law. As always, thank you both for your time. Thank you both for your analysis, and look forward to having you back.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you. All right, folks, you've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.